I want you to just imagine the last time you were sitting on a commercial jet.
Oh, yeah, just cruising along.
Right. You're cruising at 30,000 feet, sipping a ginger ale, completely relaxed. But just outside your window, inside the massive casing of that jet engine, the main shaft is screaming at 25,000 revolutions per minute.
Which is an insane amount of
It
force.
really is. Or,
Yeah.
think about a simpler moment. Driving down the highway, or even just turning on a high-end blender in your kitchen. At the very heart of all that motion, bearing the literal weight of the world, are rolling bearings. And to most of us, they look like, well, incredibly simple objects, just shiny metal rings with steel balls trapped between them.
Exactly. They seem almost primitive, right? A perfectly polished steel ball rolling on a perfectly polished steel track. But that shiny surface is a complete illusion.
Because it's not actually perfectly smooth.
Not at all. Because if you zoom in, if you look at the microscopic structure of that metal, you enter a world of absolute extreme engineering. It is a hidden war zone of microscopic stresses and atomic chemistry.
And that hidden war zone is exactly what we are getting into today on this deep dive. We're pulling from an incredibly comprehensive review on the metallurgy of bearing steels, put together by HKDH Padeshia, who is a leading expert in the field.
It's a fantastic paper. Really thorough.
Yeah, it's massive. And our mission for this deep dive is simple. We are going to shatter the illusion that bearing steel is just, basic metal. We are going to explore a century-long metallurgical arms race to create materials that can survive the most punishing, relentless, cyclic stresses on planet Earth.
It's quite the journey.
Okay, let's unpack this. Where do we even begin with a material that has to be that phenomenally tough?
We actually have to begin with a mistake.
A mistake.
Yeah, it is very easy to fall into the trap of the casual metallurgist. The source specifically calls this out. It's someone who assumes that because we've been making bearing steel for a long time, the problem is, well, completely solved.
Oh, I see. Like, we figured it out years ago, so there's nothing left to learn.
Right. They look at the absolute gold standard of the industry, a steel known as 5100. It's a high-carbon, low-alloy steel containing roughly 1% carbon and 1.5% chromium.
And this stuff is absolutely everywhere, isn't it?
Oh, everywhere. 6 million tons of bearing steel are manufactured annually, and 52100 completely dominates that market.
What blows my mind is that this specific alloy was adopted around 1905. You would naturally assume that after over a century of global use, there wouldn't be any mystery left to how it works.
You would think so, but manufacturing this 100-year champ requires an incredibly precise thermodynamic dance.
Okay, thermodynamic dance. Walk me through that.
Well, it starts with a process called spheroidized annealing. When a bearing manufacturer first receives the raw steel, it is far too hard to shape or cut.
Right, you can't carve a steel ring out of a block that's already rock hard.
Exactly. So they have to heat it in a very specific, controlled way, often for many hours. The goal is to force the carbon atoms to migrate and form into relatively coarse microscopic spheres.
Like little globes.
Yeah, globular carbides. And these just float in a softer iron matrix.
Which makes it soft enough to actually machine, right? To
Right.
cut, to form into the precise shape of a ring or a spherical ball.
Yes, exactly.
It's a lot like working with clay on a potter's wheel. You need the material to be soft and malleable while you are shaping it. But obviously, you can't put a soft clay ring into the main shaft of a jet engine.
No, that would be a disaster.
So you have to fire it in the kiln to lock in the strength.
Precisely. And in metallurgy, firing the clay means heating the steel up to about 840 degrees Celsius.
That is seriously hot.
It is.
Yeah.
And at that exact temperature, the crystal structure of the iron actually changes phase. It transforms from its room temperature state into what we call austenite.
Austenite. Okay.
And in this austenitic phase, those little globes of carbon we created earlier, they start dissolving into the iron. They disperse evenly throughout the atomic crystal lattice.
And then comes the shock to the system, right? The
Oh,
quench.
the quench is dramatic.
You drop the temperature so rapidly, usually by plunging the red-hot steel into oil or salt, that the iron desperately tries to change its crystal structure back to its room temperature shape.
But it can't.
Right. The carbon is trapped. It physically cannot diffuse out of the way fast enough, so it warps the iron lattice. It creates this impossibly hard, highly stressed microscopic structure called martensite.
Or, if you hold the temperature slightly higher at around 250 degrees for a few hours, you get a slightly tougher, intertwined structure called bainite.
Right, bainite. But sticking with martensite for a second, wait, if it's so highly stressed and locked in place, isn't it inherently brittle?
That is the big question.
Because the paper says if you make a mistake and let the austenite grains get too big during the heating phase, the resulting martensite plates actually crash into each other during the rapid quench.
They do.
They literally crack the steel from within before it has even seen a single day of use. How on earth is that a reliable material for a bearing?
What's fascinating here is that 500-100 steel is entirely a balancing act. You're absolutely right. If you dissolve too much carbon into the martensite, it becomes glass-like.
It'll just shatter.
It will simply shatter under pressure. That is exactly why that 840-degree heating temperature is chosen so carefully.
Yeah.
The metallurgists purposefully do not dissolve all the carbon into the austenite.
Wait, they leave some of it undissolved on purpose?
Yes. They intentionally leave about 3 to 4% of those original globular carbides, which are known as cementite, completely undissolved.
Ah. So you end up with this incredibly hard martensite matrix, but it is physically studded with these little undissolved carbon rocks.
Exactly. And those leftover cementite particles are actually harder than the surrounding martensite. They are absolutely crucial for resisting surface wear as the bearing continuously rolls.
Okay, that makes sense.
But by leaving them out of the main matrix, the martensite itself ends up with a slightly lower overall carbon concentration. This makes the matrix just tough and flexible enough to survive the rolling impact without shattering. It is a microscopic high wire act.
Which is an amazing feat for a recipe that is over 100 years old.
Truly.
But cooking the perfect 52100 steel recipe is only fine if your raw ingredients are flawless. What happens if the raw steel has microscopic impurities? Because bearings endure intense localized pressures. What does the source call them? Hertzian contact stresses?
Yes, Hertzian contact stress. It's a beautiful, brutal concept in physics. Mm. When a perfectly round steel ball presses against a curved steel track, the actual area of contact between them is incredibly small.
Like how small?
It's just a microscopic ellipse. So you have hundreds, sometimes thousands of pounds of force concentrated onto a point the size of a pinhead.
Wow.
And counterintuitively, the maximum shear stress, the tearing force that wants to rip the metal apart, it doesn't happen right at the surface. It peaks slightly below the surface of the metal.
So underneath that shiny, perfect mirror finish, the steel is basically experiencing a microscopic earthquake every single time a ball rolls over it.
That's a great way to describe it.
Which explains the absolute obsession with cleanliness in the manufacturing process. Because if you have even a microscopic speck of dirt or a chemical impurity right at that specific depth where the shear stress is peaking,
the metal gives way. It leads to catastrophic, premature failure.
Just from one speck.
Just one. This is why modern bearing manufacturers are fanatical about removing impurities from the melt. We are talking about keeping oxygen levels strictly under 10 parts per million by weight.
10 parts per million, that is practically nothing.
To achieve that level of purity, they use an intensive process called vacuum arc remelting.
Okay, how does that work?
They essentially take a solid rod of the raw steel and use it as an electrode inside a massive vacuum chamber. They strike an electrical arc, and the steel slowly melts, drop by drop, like a leaky faucet.
Falling through a vacuum.
Right. As the molten droplets fall, the gaseous impurities are literally sucked out of the metal, while solid impurities float to the very top of the molten pool, where they can be physically cropped off later.
But even with all that intense vacuum processing, you still get these non-metallic inclusions left behind. And there's a specific impurity that creates a brutal metallurgical catch-22. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, the aluminum.
Yes. To get the oxygen out of the molten steel before it solidifies, manufacturers purposefully add aluminum to the mix.
Right, as a deoxidizer.
The aluminum actively bonds with the oxygen to create alumina, which is lighter and floats to the top to be skimmed off. But, you know, you never get all of it out.
You really don't.
That exact chemical cleaning process leaves behind microscopic alumina particles trapped in the final steel. It's like using crushed eggshells to fish out a piece of eggshell from your pancake batter and accidentally baking the new shells into your breakfast.
That is a highly visual analogy, but it's completely accurate. The problem with alumina in the final hardened steel is that it is extremely rigid.
Too rigid for the steel.
Yes. When the bearing is put to work, the surrounding steel matrix naturally deforms slightly under those massive Hertzian contact stresses.
Yeah.
But the alumina particle refuses to form. It just sits there, completely rigid.
Oh, I see.
Because it won't flex with the steel. Tiny microscopic voids, empty spaces tear open around the particle. And those voids become the perfect birthplace for fatigue cracks to start growing.
Okay, so alumina is a massive problem because it's too rigid and creates empty spaces in the matrix. But is there an impurity that actively attacks the surrounding metal, something that does more than just sit there?
Yes, and that brings us to titanium carbon nitrides.
Titanium carbon nitrides.
Right. Unlike alumina, which creates empty voids, these inclusions bond incredibly strongly to the surrounding steel matrix. And they aren't round. They form into sharp, microscopic, cubic structures.
Sharp, microscopic cubes bonding to the steel under pressure. That sounds like a recipe for disaster.
It is. And this is where the thermal physics of the manufacturing process comes into play. You have to consider the thermal expansion coefficients of these different materials.
Meaning how much they shrink when they cool down.
Exactly. When the newly forged steel cools down from its extreme manufacturing temperatures, it naturally shrinks. But those titanium carbon nitride inclusions shrink at a significantly slower rate than the steel matrix surrounding them.
Oh, wow. So as the whole thing cools down, the steel is trying to shrink tight, but the cube in the middle stays relatively large. They don't fit together perfectly anymore.
Exactly. Because of that mismatch in shrinkage, it creates a permanent microscopic bubble of residual tensile stress around the inclusion.
A bubble of stress.
The seal is literally pulling itself apart around that particle forever. It is a ticking time bomb built right into the metal.
That's terrifying.
And because those titanium carbon nitride particles have sharp corners and are bonded strongly to the steel, when the rolling pressure hits them, they don't just sit there. They crack like tiny wedges, driving fractures directly into the already stressed steel matrix.
The idea that there are microscopic bubbles of tension just waiting to pop is wild. Every time you drive to the grocery store, billions of tiny wedges are experiencing micro earthquakes trying to tear your wheel bearings apart.
But they usually don't.
Right. The 1520-100 steel holds up. The precision of the matrix keeps those forces at bay, making it a miracle material for everyday use. But the physical rules change completely when you leave the ground.
They absolutely do.
If you put a standard 1520-100 bearing in an advanced aerospace environment, the baseline steel simply gives up.
Literally. 1520-100 steel begins to soften significantly if it operates much above 160 degrees Celsius.
Which isn't that hot for a jet engine.
Not at all.
Yeah.
It completely loses that hard martensitic edge that prevents wear. In a modern aero engine, you have bearings operating right next to roaring combustion chambers, dealing with extreme continuous heat. And on top of that, they're spinning at that 25,000 RPM we discussed earlier.
Right. At 25,000 RPM, the centrifugal forces are immense. It creates what engineers call hoop stresses.
Yes.
The bearing ring is spinning so fast, it is physically trying to expand, attempting to rip itself apart from the inside out. So how do you solve for extreme heat and massive tearing forces at the exact same time?
Well, you need a fundamentally different alloy. Enter a material called M50 steel.
M50? What makes it different?
It utilizes a heavy dose of molybdenum, which is a key alloying element that allows the steel to maintain its structural hardness all the way up to 315 degrees Celsius.
Wow, so it doubles the heat resistance.
Roughly, yeah. It is a marvel of high-temperature metallurgy. But there is significant vulnerability.
Let me guess. If M50 is through-hardened, meaning it is uniformly hard and heat-resistant all the way from the surface to the core, doesn't that make the entire ring vulnerable to shattering from those massive hoop stresses?
Exactly. Because it is uniformly hard, it is inherently brittle throughout.
Ah.
If a fatigue crack starts at the surface and meets the immense tension of the centrifugal hoop stress, the crack can propagate straight through the ring instantly.
And in a jet engine, a shattered main shaft bearing isn't just a failure, it is a catastrophic event.
It's the worst case scenario.
So they needed a material that was incredibly hard on the outside to handle the rolling friction and the heat, but flexible enough on the inside to survive the centrifugal stretching without snapping.
Yes.
And the solution they developed is called M50-NEL, and I absolutely love the engineering behind this.
It's very clever.
They essentially created a composite structure. They start with a low-carbon, tough, flexible steel core, but then they carburize the outer case.
Right, they infuse it with carbon.
They literally bake extra carbon only into the very outer skin of the metal. It makes the bearing function exactly like a peanut M&M.
A peanut M&M.
Yeah. You have this super hard, crunchy outer shell to take all the surface friction and rolling wear, but a chewy, tough center to absorb the engine's massive vibrations and hoop stresses without ever shattering.
That composite structure is a brilliant workaround for the limitations of a single alloy. But the aerospace challenges push metallurgists even further when you look at spacecraft.
Oh, like the space shuttle.
Consider the space shuttle fuel pumps. These pumps had to move cryogenic liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen.
So it's insanely cold.
Extreme cold, extreme rotational speeds, and an incredibly corrosive environment all at once.
Mm-hmm. Initially for those shuttle pumps, the standard choice was 440C stainless steel, which makes perfect sense on paper, right? It has a high chromium content to resist corrosion and high carbon to make it hard.
It makes sense until you actually test it in those conditions.
Right. Because at those extreme cryogenic temperatures, 440C revealed a fatal flaw. The carbon and chromium naturally want to bond together, creating massive, chunky chromium carbides inside the metal.
Very blocky structures.
Yeah, they're huge blocky structures compared to the fine, delicate carbides in 5100. And in the freezing cold, those giant carbides acted like boulders in a stream, creating massive stress concentrations that completely ruined the toughness of the metal.
It became far too brittle to survive.
So what did they do?
The metallurgists had to completely rethink the fundamental chemistry of the steel.
Yeah.
The solution they eventually engineered is a material called Kronidur 30.
Kronidur 30?
They realized that carbon was the culprit causing those chunky, brittle carbides to form. So they radically replaced a massive amount of the carbon in the recipe with nitrogen.
Nitrogen, like the gas.
Yes. Nitrogen can harden the steel matrix similarly to carbon, but it doesn't form those giant blocky structures.
That's brilliant.
However, you cannot just stir nitrogen gas into a vat of molten steel.
I can't imagine not.
To force the nitrogen atoms into the iron lattice, they have to melt the steel under 42 bars of atmospheric pressure.
42 times normal atmospheric pressure just to bake the nitrogen gas into the solid metal.
And the result is a hyperuniform, incredibly tough, highly corrosion-resistant marvel that performs beautifully at cryogenic temperatures.
That is unbelievable engineering.
Looking at M50 Nili and Kronidur 30 proves a fundamental rule of advanced material science. There is no such thing as a universally perfect steel. There is only the perfectly engineered steel for a specific operational environment.
So we can engineer a composite structure like an M&M to survive extreme physical force, and we can bake in nitrogen under massive pressure to survive extreme space environments. But what happens when the environment itself sneaks an invisible chemical assassin into the metal to destroy it from the inside out?
Ah, you're referring to hydrogen.
Yes.
Hydrogen is arguably the ultimate stealth killer of high-strength bearing steels. We mentioned earlier the obsession with keeping impurities out during manufacturing, but hydrogen often sneaks in while the bearing is operating.
Sure, from the air.
It can easily seep into the atomic lattice from atmospheric moisture or even from the chemical degradation of the bearing's own lubricating oil under extreme heat and pressure.
That's insidious.
And the scary part is the concentration required. Just one part per million of hydrogen can drastically reduce the fatigue life of the metal.
One part per million. It's almost nothing. But wait, how does a single hydrogen atom actually kill a massive block of hardened steel? The scientific community has been debating this for years, right? There are two competing theories, softening versus embrittlement.
Correct. The first theory is often called hydrogen-enhanced localized plasticity, or the softening theory.
Okay.
The idea here is that microscopic hydrogen atoms slip into the crystal lattice and actually lubricate the movement of atomic dislocations.
Lubricate the atoms.
Yes. It locally makes it too easy for the metal planes to slide past each other.
Yeah.
This causes extreme localized microplasticity, essentially turning microscopic pockets of the steel to mush, which eventually tears the surrounding metal apart under the rolling pressure.
And the other theory is embrittlement, right? Where the hydrogen atoms wedge themselves directly between the iron atoms and chemically interfere with the atomic bonds themselves.
Precisely.
They physically weaken the attractive force holding the iron together, making the steel fundamentally more brittle and prone to unzipping or shattering like glass.
Exactly. And to figure out how these fatigue mechanisms actually work over millions and millions of cycles, scientists have to develop entirely new ways to test the metal.
Because you can't just wait around.
Right. If you want to know how a bearing fails after 10 years, you can't just put it on a test rig and wait 10 years.
Yeah.
So they utilize gigacycle ultrasonic fatigue testing.
Gigacycle.
They attach a small sample of the bearing steel to a piezoelectric horn and vibrate it at 20,000 hertz.
Wait, 20,000 cycles every single second?
Yes. This allows them to simulate millions of rolling stress cycles in a matter of hours.
So what does this all mean? Because if hydrogen is this slow-moving, invisible assassin, and it needs physical time to literally diffuse and migrate through the solid metal lattice to find the microscopic cracks where the damage is happening.
I see where you're going with this.
Isn't vibrating the metal at 20,000 hertz completely cheating the physics? The hydrogen atoms literally do not have the time to move to the stress points. Does this super-fast ultrasonic test actually represent the chemical reality of a bearing running in a real machine for 5 years?
That is an excellent piece of critical thinking, and it highlights a major point of contention in the field.
So it is a problem.
The rate of hydrogen diffusion is simply too slow to keep up with a 20 kilohertz vibration. So the hydrogen is effectively frozen in place during the accelerated test, rendering it far less harmful than it would be in a real-world application. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it underscores a profound limitation in materials engineering. You cannot accurately test mechanical stress and chemical environments in complete isolation.
Because they interact with time.
Exactly. The frequency of the physical stress fundamentally changes the chemical reaction of the material. A wind turbine bearing rotating slowly at 50 hertz for 10 years is experiencing a completely different chemical reality than a test sample vibrating at 20,000 hertz for an afternoon.
Which means predicting exactly when a bearing is going to fail in the real world is never going to be a perfect exact science. Because you can't know exactly which microscopic titanium carbon nitride inclusion is going to crack first, or exactly how much hydrogen has seeped into the metal.
No, you really can't.
It ultimately becomes an incredibly complex game of statistics.
Precisely. Because we cannot predict the exact moment of failure for an individual microscopic inclusion, engineering bearing life relies heavily on probability models, specifically the viable distribution and the Lundberg-Palmgren equations.
And this isn't just abstract math. The Weibull distribution is essentially a weakest link probability curve, right?
Yes, that's a good way to look at it.
Instead of trying to design a perfectly unbreakable bearing, which is physically impossible, engineers use this statistical distribution to map out exactly how a large population of bearings will fail over time.
Yes, the Lundberg-Palmgren model takes all the physical variables. The load, the speed, the volume of material, experiencing that subsurface shear stress we talked about earlier, and runs it through the Weibull statistics.
To find a specific number.
The ultimate goal is to calculate the L10 or B10 life. This is the exact number of operational hours at which you can statistically expect 10% of a given batch of bearings to fail.
Oh, I see. So you don't wait for the failure to happen?
Never. You mandate that the entire system be serviced and the bearings replaced long before you hit that 10% threshold. You are mathematically predicting when that invisible microscopic damage will finally link up, break the surface, and become a macroscopic spall.
A physical piece of metal flaking off the track.
Exactly.
And you, listening right now, why should you care about Lundberg-Palmgren equations or Weibull distributions? Because your safety relies entirely on those statistical curves.
It really does.
Every smooth car ride you take, every functioning computer fan keeping your hard drive from melting down, and every commercial flight you board relies on this hidden metallurgical war against fatigue. The engineers have mapped the chaos of the microscopic world so accurately that we all get to just take the silence of a spinning wheel completely for granted.
It is a profound triumph of unseen engineering. But, you know, there's one final, almost philosophical concept from the review that I think really challenges how we view these supposedly static pieces of metal.
What's that?
The text details a specific phase of a bearing's early operational life called shakedown.
Shakedown? It sounds like a mob movie.
It does, but in metallurgy, it's actually about survival.
Okay, how so?
It is a phase of physical adaptation. When a bearing is first installed and put into service, the extreme localized loads often exceed the true elastic limit of the steel in very specific microscopic areas.
Meaning the metal bends and can't just bounce back to its original shape.
Right. So the steel plastically deforms. It physically changes its internal crystal structure and shape just a tiny bit. But in doing so, it work hardens.
It gets stronger.
Yes. By deforming, the atomic lattice becomes stronger and more resistant in the exact microscopic places where the stress is highest.
Wow.
Eventually, the metal settles into a purely elastic state, fully capable of surviving continuous loads it absolutely could not handle on day one. It effectively heals its own stress points.
The metal dynamically adapts to the load. That is wild.
Which raises an important question and something I want to leave you to think about. If seemingly simple metal rings can dynamically adapt their microscopic structure to survive extreme loads they weren't originally shaped for, well, what else is possible?
Yeah.
Could we intentionally engineer other everyday materials, from the massive steel foundations of our skyscrapers to the artificial titanium joints we put in our bodies, to autonomously work harden and adapt to stress?
Could we design synthetic materials that don't just passively withstand extreme environmental forces, but actually evolve through friction, becoming permanently stronger over time, almost like living tissue responding to exercise?
A piece of metal that exercises and builds muscle. I absolutely love that thought.
Right. So the next time you are sitting on that flight, cruising at 30,000 feet, look out the window at that massive spinning engine. Remember that the steel keeping you safely in the air isn't just a basic, dumb chunk of metal.
Definitely not.
It is a carefully fired, vacuum clean, perfectly balanced matrix of carbon and iron, fighting an invisible microscopic war and physically adapting to win.